From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, I speak with conductor, composer, and pianist Lucas Foss, music director of the Brooklyn Philharmonic. Throughout his career, he's championed the works of contemporary composers. Also today, we meet actor Saeed Jaffrey. He played the uncle in the film My Beautiful Laundrette. He co-stars with Pierce Brosnan in the new film The Deceivers, which was shot on location in Jaffrey's native India. With summer winding down, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the songs and the performers he thinks will remember the season by, and film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Eight Men Out, John Sayles' new movie about baseball's biggest scandal. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. My guest is composer, conductor, and performer Lucas Foss, who over the years has been one of America's most committed champions of new music. As a composer, he's been identified with serialism, improvisation, and chance processes. When he conducted the Buffalo Philharmonic from 1963 to 1970, he created controversy by turning that city into a center for modern music. Since 1971, he served as music director and conductor of the Brooklyn Philharmonic, where he programs concerts of both classical and new music. Foss is also now conductor laureate of the Milwaukee Symphony Orchestra and is a former conductor of the Jerusalem Symphony. Foss was a child prodigy who began writing music at age 7 and who at 23 was the youngest composer to ever receive a Guggenheim Fellowship. Before we hear from him, let's listen to an excerpt of one of his compositions, which shows both his adventurousness and his love of the classics. This is from Baroque Variations on a Bach Prelude, featuring Lucas Foss conducting the Buffalo Philharmonic as recorded in 1968. Lucas Foss, you're a conductor, composer, and performer. Were you ever pressured to specialize and keep to just one of those roles?
It seems that maybe I should have, because I'm going crazy having so many lives.
Do you think that your musical interests are the same in each of those lives?
No, it depends on what I'm doing. I mean, there are moments when I'm composing and wished I were conducting, moments when I'm conducting, wished I were composing. But on the whole, after all, I'm not the first who's doing this. What about Mendelssohn, Mahler, Bernstein? I mean, it's done all the time. Boulez. So I'm in good company, and I think one fertilizes the other.
As a conductor, you've introduced a lot of audiences to new music. When you started as a conductor, bringing new music to American audiences, did you ever want to shock those audiences to get a kind of rite of spring response?
No, I don't believe that it's my business to shock an audience. I think that I like to surprise them, which means open a door for them. But shock, I think not. Unless you, maybe shock is one of those surprises. If it's in the music, yes. But I don't remember composing anything specially in order to shock people, nor do I remember conducting anything in a special way to shock people.
Do you think that's a kind of immature response to want to shock people?
Yes, I think that there may be fringe benefits in that, or cringe benefits, maybe I should say. But I don't think it's a very musical attitude.
You were very controversial in Buffalo, where you conducted in the 1960s. As a matter of fact, I think you once had to answer your critics on a Buffalo television station because there was such an uproar created from the new music that you were bringing in.
That's true. In those days, we did quite a bit of experimenting. Now I'm a little easier, I think, on audience and orchestra. I like to sort of prod them along so that they want the adventurous rather than just suddenly throw it at them. I like to make sure that they're ready for it. But in those days, in those Buffalo days, we just suddenly decided to do something and we did it. And it divided the city into two camps, maybe. But that was part of the fun.
Do you remember what you said on that television station when you had to justify what you were doing?
No, what did I say?
I don't know. I was hoping you'd remember.
I don't know.
Yeah, it's interesting. In the Brooklyn Philharmonic, you've basically come up with two separate programs, one program for traditional classical music and another for contemporary music. Have you done that because of the experiences that you've had? Do you think that the audiences remain divided into two camps?
There is no doubt about that. But even in our so-called subscription concerts, the classically oriented ones, I try to inject some adventure into those. And then sometimes in the modern music programs, we're also doing things that are quite accessible. But Meet the Moderns is, of course, designed for people who are interested in what's new and what's going on today in the innovative. So I think these are two different audiences.
Composer and conductor Lucas Foss is my guest. In the Village Voice, music critic Tom Johnson once described you as, this is what he wrote. He wrote, "The young Foss was about the closest thing contemporary music ever had to a real Mozart-caliber child prodigy." Now you started composing, I think, when you were about 7 years old.
That's true.
What got you started?
We had a harmonium, and I tried to play some hymn tunes on it and then try to find my own harmony. And then it was decided that Lucas was ready to have some piano lessons. So they got a piano, and I began to compose music along with the first piano piece. You see, when I was just able to play a little two-part invention, I immediately wanted to write one. In other words, I wanted to do myself what I loved. And that's been that way for a long time. I wrote the music I loved. Then one day, much later, a door opened, and I thought to myself, well, but one could do this instead. And so I became suddenly, not that sudden, but wildly avant-garde and experimental. And now I am in a period where I'm actually reconciling my earlier traditional music with these experimental things. In other words, I'm trying to be just as crazy and adventurous while at the same time being romantic and close to the music I always loved that made me become a composer in the first place, Bach, Mozart, Beethoven, and so forth.
When you were young and showing all of this talent, were you fussed over by teachers and by your parents?
There was a lot of support, a great deal of support. I mean, I think that's true of anybody precocious, is that they have very supportive parents. I couldn't have done better, but that also has its drawbacks because, of course, a supportive parent expects a lot too, which means that mother would say, why don't you walk around the garden? Maybe you'll think of a beautiful melody. Okay, so what happens? I think, yes, but what if I don't think of anything? Then I'm letting down mother. In other words, early fears of creative impotence, you lose your youth that way because you become too responsible too early. And that is true of all child prodigies. So that's the other side of the coin. And at the same time, I'm very lucky because an early start is a great help.
Well, how much did you let that pressure get to you when you were young?
Well, I don't really know. I'm sure it was there because I remember it. At the age of 8, I tried to write an opera. At the age of 9, I decided my act 1 was childish and gave up.
I should hope it would be childish.
Exactly. So, but you see, a composer is always very critical of himself. And I was critical already then. That's what happens when you start so young. You already look suspiciously at what you have wrought and say, is that really as good as what I did yesterday?
You fled Nazi Germany with your parents in 1933. Do you remember much of that experience?
Well, my father was a philosopher, and he knew what would happen. He just had that insight, and he took the whole family to Paris. And after 4 years of France, where I also studied music, he said, we're still too close to trouble. And we came to America when I was 15. And then I went to the Curtis Institute and I immediately started publishing music, age 15, because I had already 8 years of composing behind me. So it all happened that way. But America is really my home. When I now go to France or Germany, I mean, it's like going traveling.
Were you exposed to a different kind of teaching style in Paris than you got when you came to America?
Yes, but not because of the style of the country, but because of the particular people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, every teacher has such a different approach. The French approach was at that time very quite academic. And as a matter of fact, when I began studying at the Curtis with the old teacher of Minotti and Barber, who was then very old, by the time I got a hold of him, he was extremely academic and I couldn't stand it. I couldn't graduate fast enough to get out of that. And then I studied with Hindemith later on at Yale University.
Well, you had a very, you know, formal, pretty traditional music training in your early years. What led you into the experimentation, the avant-garde radicalism that you started writing and conducting?
That was probably my project in chamber improvisation, which I started as a professor at UCLA around 1956, trying to invent out of envy of jazz a kind of non-jazz improvisation. And so we started to improvise, but one day my friend Piatigorsky said, you know, it sounds like music badly remembered, what we improvised. And he was so right. So I asked myself, what would be the kind of music that would thrive on the improvisational process? And with that question, I let in the whole Pandora's box of troubles, namely aleatoric music. Alias means chance, dice. In other words, 3 years before the word got coined, we were already working with these concepts of chance music in improvisation. And then finally I turned my back to improvisation, but meanwhile it hadn't changed my students at UCLA nearly as much as it has changed me.
You know, one of the interesting things about chance processes is that I think for a composer, it could free you from your own limitations and free you from your own personal taste.
You're right. It gives you something, very often something to start with, whether you do what John Cage does, which is throw dice, or whether you do what Schoenberg did, which is start with a 12-tone row. You get something that helps you put notes on the empty piece of paper, either because you have a row to start with. In other words, it gives you something to do when instead of sitting there staring into a vacant space.
Is that why you started doing it, to try to break out of what you perceived to be your own taste or personal limitations?
That wasn't in my case, no. I think it was that chamber improvisation ensemble that did it to me. It was that door that opened when I suddenly saw all these unexplored territories and I got interested. See, young people are not very adventurous. They're usually traditionalists. They want to do what they love, and they love what's old, what they're used to. Young and old people are the same in that respect. But when you reach maturity, suddenly there's something in you that wants to venture out, and you get very excited about that possibility. So when that opened up to me, I went all the way.
Did you get to the point where you wanted some of the composer's prerogative back, where you wanted to be able to control it all yourself?
As a matter of fact, our improvisations were very controlled in a certain way, and then I gave up improvisation precisely because I saw the limits of it. I didn't want to... You see, improvisers, they play what they know. They don't play what they don't know. They fall into clichés, routine. So I found that by going back into my ivory tower, I could be more adventurous, alone, composing with a pencil in my hand. I could afford to be more adventurous than in the dangerous situation of ensemble improvisation, where there's traffic and traffic controls, and therefore you have to be careful. In improvisation, with others, you have to be careful. But when you compose, you don't have to be careful.
The teaching position that you had when you founded this improvisatory chamber group, that was a position you'd taken over from Arnold Schoenberg, right, as a professor of composition?
Yes, I guess I was then the youngest full professor at UCLA, and I didn't even have a high school diploma.
Well, did they expect you to be as radical as he had been as a teacher?
They didn't expect me anything of the sort. They took me because they knew my work and they thought I would do a good job. No, that all happened on its own accord.
So you really changed on them.
Yes. Schoenberg opened up to me much later through things like these improvisation experiments. Suddenly I discovered atonality and then suddenly understood what Schoenberg did to atonality, why he had to do what he did, how he had to limit the overwhelming choices through tone rows.
So when you returned to composition after your experiments with chance and improvisation, your composition was changed by those experiments that you had done.
Absolutely. It changed me, as I said, more than it changed my students. And that was quite a lesson. And then, of course, I got deeper and deeper into conducting, but that also, in a sense, helped my composition. I don't think it hindered. It got to the point recently where I had to say to myself, I can't do everything. So now, for instance, I find myself, after 5 years as music director of the Milwaukee Symphony, find myself as conductor laureate there with only 4 weeks at the helm instead of 14. That's a help. And I still have the wonderful Brooklyn Orchestra, but that too is an enormous chore, and sometimes I just run out of time. You see, when you have two lives, the danger is, do you live at all?
Right. I guess it's always been hard to find personal time, too.
Yes. But conducting is a wonderful, the other side of the coin, you know. It's great to get relief from one work through the other. So I don't think I'll ever give it up.
I want to talk more about your life and your music, but we're going to take a short break first. My guest is composer and conductor Lucas Foss. We'll be back after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
Lucas Foss is my guest, who is the conductor of the Brooklyn Philharmonic. As a composer, did you ever have trouble finding musicians who could play your work? I think that's frequently been a problem with composers of new music, that there's sometimes ideas that musicians aren't ready to interpret yet.
You know, if I didn't know everybody, and as a conductor I do, and as a composer I also met a lot of musicians who are interested in new music, if I were all alone in some small city, probably I would have that problem. But living in New York, where there are so many wonderful virtuosos, there is more supply than demand. It's unbelievable. Just the other day, there was a concert of my music, and the virtuosity was just incredible. So I think in that respect, we composers are very lucky. We have people who are devoted, dedicated, interested in new music, and when something catches their fancy, they really work hard and they deliver.
Well, you actually started a program in Buffalo, New York, which became known as the Creative Associates Program, where you brought in musicians from around the world, really, to specialize in performing in new music. And I think that was an important step in bringing musicians together to perform new works.
Yes, that was based on a very sound idea, I think, namely, until you graduate, you study and you're interested in all kinds of things and you serve music because you want to know. Then suddenly you expect all this to serve you and to make money, and you're in a professional situation, you stop learning and you choose the quickest way and you go into an orchestra and you sit there playing the second violin for the rest of your life. There should be a few years in between study and the rat race where you really find out about things that you couldn't have found out just as a student, where you have to already be a skilled virtuoso to really find out. And so we built that center in Buffalo that went on for many, many years, which took only skilled virtuosi, young people who wanted to know and find out about new music. And that very often changed their whole goal and therefore made all the difference in their future approach to music.
Could I ask you what got you back into classical music after all of your experimentation with atonality and serialism and chance processes, improvisation? Because you're conducting a lot of classics now as well as new music.
Yes, of course, but that's an easy question because I never left home. In other words, since home was Mozart, Bach, Beethoven, Verdi, Tchaikovsky, Wagner, since that was my home, I never left it. I was always close to that music. As a matter of fact, in my most avant-garde days, I needed it. I needed that. You see, the best thing is to have one big foot in the past and a big foot in the future. I'll confess to you that I'm happiest when I conduct the old masters.
Why?
Because that's where I come from, and because that is the music I've known all my life. That I do for memory. Whereas when I conduct my latest work from, if in front of an orchestra, my eyes are pinned to the music lest I get lost in the score. I mean, that is, it's a matter of what you've known and loved all your life. And to make that fresh again, make that as if the ink were not yet dry, that is part of the fun of conducting for me. That's why I conduct. And I think I have a sort of a direct line to the classics as a composer that many conductors might not have. And that makes conducting the classics so interesting. I mean, I can take a Beethoven symphony and literally bring out the humor, bring out everything that would make it fresh instead of standing there polishing it like an old shoe.
So do you think that you're interpreting the classics from a contemporary perspective?
You might call it that. I don't know. I that sounds like I was trying to make it sound different from what it is. No, I try to put an intelligent searchlight and a loving searchlight on it so that it is exactly what it is because it was new music. So when we do it now, let's do it what it was, new music. But unfortunately, that is not done. I feel a real mission, a need to show to orchestras and audiences what that music really is, because it isn't done that way today.
You've seen the very radical, very personal music of one composer or of one generation end up inspiring others, being copied by others, and hardening into mannerisms, hardening into style.
Mm-hmm.
What has that experience made you think about? About how something that's really fresh and radical can, down the line, end up as mannerism?
Well, that is what we hear day in, day out. We hear performances where every time the note goes up, you get a crescendo. Every time a few notes go down, you get a diminuendo. You hear stupid espressivos superimposed. You get all the things that are supposed to make music effective. Well, they make mediocre music more effective. It's like a gravy, a spice. It's you pour it on. It's like turning on loudspeakers as loud as you can. Then you get power. These are performance practices that help mediocre music, but unfortunately they're being applied to great music, where the uniqueness is lost if you apply these little effective devices, this gravy that goes on bad food. If you apply that to great music, you make it less effective. If you put a lot of ornaments into weak music, Baroque music, you make it more lively, more interesting for the virtuoso. If you do that to Bach, you're making him sound like every other piece of Baroque music. So you rob it of its uniqueness. And that is very often what performance practice does. It robs a piece of uniqueness of its uniqueness and puts on a sort of standardized notions that are supposed to create bigger audience appeal.
What do you see as your role now in your position as conductor in scouting out new music and new composers?
Well, it seems I am some kind of a one-man clearinghouse for new music because there's not a day going by that composers don't send me their latest cassette, their latest scores. And my studio isn't large enough for it. I don't know anymore what to do. The music is all over the place. I try to keep up with it. Sometimes I can, sometimes I just can't. But it's fun when I discover something that I really think this is interesting. I'm not looking for masterworks. I'm just looking for something that's interesting. And then I'd also try to schedule it somewhere, perform it if I possibly can. Although programming is such a crossword puzzle that I cannot always do everything I want to. Anyway, there's much too much. What can I do?
When you were 17 years old, Time magazine had a short story about you, and you were quoted in that Time magazine article as saying, "I want to write music in a modern idiom that appeals to the ear." What would you change in describing yourself now?
I wouldn't say that entire sentence now, because first of all, I just want to write music. I'm not worried now about a modern idiom. Did I really say that? Have you got it in front of you or something?
Yes, I do, and that's how they quoted you, which isn't necessarily to say that's exactly the way you said it. People have been known to be misquoted, but that is definitely the way it was written.
That's about, what, 10 years ago? Why? Wow. Well, we won't say how many years ago, but I sure have changed. Now, I couldn't care less about idiom. In fact, I'm rather proud of the fact that I'm not trendy, because what is trendy isn't going to be trendy in a few years from now. Trendy means fashionable. And what's fashionable means it couldn't possibly be fashionable 10 years from now. It means it's just here today and gone tomorrow. So I don't believe in the trendy. And I must say, I did everything a little bit at the wrong time. And there, because I did things when they interested me. The modern idiom, I don't even know what that is.
What about the idea that you want to write music that appeals to the ear? Is that a given, or is that something that you just don't think about?
I don't think about it, because some dissonances are wonderful. They appeal to Ives' ears, and they will not appeal to some other ears. It depends on the ears that are listening, but I do believe that music is written for others. In other words, we write for brothers and sisters. We write for people in the same boat, in the same trouble, and not for ourselves. So we don't necessarily want to appeal to them. That is, we don't try to make it big at the box office or something like that, but we do write for others. We want to communicate.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about your music. Thank you for joining us. And I also want to wish you a happy belated birthday.
Thank you.
I spoke with Lucas Foss just after his 65th birthday last October. He's the conductor and music director of the Brooklyn Philharmonic, which will begin its 35th season later this month. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Singer Benny King will be our guest on the next Fresh Air. He sang lead with the Drifters in the early 60s and also had solo hits including I Who Have Nothing and Stand By Me. I hope you can join us.
When the night has come and the land is dark, and the moon is the only light we'll see. No, I won't be afraid. Oh, I won't be afraid. Just as long as you stand by me. So, darling. Should tumble and fall, or the mountain should crumble to the sea. I won't cry, I won't cry, no, I won't shed a tear, just as long as you stand by me.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional funding comes from World of Travel Guidebooks, featuring a removable travel planner designed for the intelligent, inquisitive traveler. Additional support comes from NPR member stations and from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Saeed Jafri was taught how to use a silk scarf as a weapon for strangling. It was part of the training for his role as a member of an Indian criminal cult in the new movie The Deceivers. Coming up, Jafri talks about being an Indian actor on Broadway, a Shakespearean actor in Delhi, and a murderer in the movies. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker closes out the summer with his picks for the most memorable records. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Eight Men Out, John Sayles' look at the year the White Sox threw the World Series. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. Thousands of workers in Poland have heeded an appeal from Solidarity leader Lech Wałęsa and ended their strikes. Wałęsa won assurances yesterday from the Polish government that it would consider strikers' key demand, legalization of Solidarity. Jane Dobia reports.
Workers at the Lenin shipyard in Gdańsk were hesitant to follow Wałęsa's call. But after an all-night debate, the strikers marched out of the yard this afternoon to chants and cheers from a crowd of about 3,000. Most workers in Poland followed the Lenin shipyard's example and ended their strikes, but miners in Jastrzębie say they're holding out for guarantees that they won't be fired and that they'll be allowed safe exit from their workplace. Similar issues are preventing a quick settlement to a strike by dockhands in the port of Gdańsk. Transportation workers in Szczecin are also still on strike. Solidarity leader Jacek Kuron says the Polish government is running against the clock to settle workers' political and economic grievances. He says that a peaceful solution to the current conflict would be better for all sides. But if a people's revolution is necessary, Kuron warns, we will build one. For National Public Radio, I'm Jane Dobia in Warsaw.
Nelson Mandela has been moved from a Cape Town hospital to a private clinic for treatment of tuberculosis. The late-night transfer of the anti-apartheid leader prompted speculation today that the South African government might not return Mandela to Paulsmoor Prison, where he contracted the disease. It's reported that officials are concerned such a move would create an international outcry. Meanwhile, Mandela's lawyer says his client's transfer to the multiracial Cape Town clinic is not significant, that the 70-year-old Mandela remains a prisoner whose release he considers doubtful. The United States today condemned a bombing raid by the Afghan government on Pakistan, calling it a violation of the Geneva Peace Accords. The Pakistani government said one person was killed in the attack. The Soviet news agency TASS confirmed reports by Western diplomats that Afghan rebels today launched a rocket attack which badly damaged Kabul airport. Details from George Arney in Islamabad.
TASS gives few details beyond saying that storage facilities and transport aircraft were damaged in the attack and that the resulting fires were eventually put out. Western diplomatic sources in Islamabad provide a rather more detailed and graphic account. They say the attack began in the early afternoon with a salvo of rockets, one of which is reported to have hit a transport aircraft loaded with weapons and ammunition. That blew up. Sometime later, another rocket apparently hit a major ammunition depot, triggering a series of explosions which lasted for more than an hour and sent shockwaves through the whole area. Black smoke was seen rising hundreds of feet into the air. The diplomats don't have any details about casualties, but they believe that damage must have been severe. The airport was evacuated and closed down.
Correspondent George Arney. Federal regulators say critics of the Suzuki Samurai have failed to demonstrate that the sport utility vehicle has an excessive tendency to roll over. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration today denied a recall petition filed by the Center for Auto Safety. The agency did, however, begin proceedings to establish standards to protect drivers of all light-duty vehicles against unreasonable risk of rollover. The Traffic Safety Administration said the rollover crash involvement of the Samurai appears to be within the range of most other light utility vehicles. The agency said rollovers appear to have been influenced by adverse driver and environmental factors, such as high-risk driving maneuvers, drinking, low ambient light, and lack of driver familiarity with either the vehicle or the road. Stock prices dropped sharply today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell more than 29 points to close at 2002.31. Declines led advances 3-1 on volume of 144 million shares. You're listening to NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Summertime almost demands that we have music playing in the background, at the beach and the barbecue. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a reflection on the music he's been hearing this season, like this song by Steve Winwood.
Summer is just about over, and looking back, or hearing it back, there were songs that took over the season. One of them was that one, Steve Winwood's Don't You Know What the Night Can Do. One reason this song was so pervasive was that it's not only on Winwood's new album, but it's also the music for a Michelob beer commercial, and as such, it's kicked up a little controversy. Heard on its own, Don't You Know What the Night Can Do is a nice piece of blue-eyed soul music for the 80s. Placed in the context of a beer commercial, however, many people are hearing that song as a shameful sellout. It's been said that Winwood wrote the song as a commercial jingle first, and then decided to include it on his album, which, if true, is one of those revelations that rock purists decry as awful cynicism. Winwood's manager has felt obliged to deny this charge, and told Billboard magazine that his client, quote, doesn't drink Michelob, he's not a big drinker. My own feeling is that music, and especially pop music, is probably inspired by absolutely anything. And it doesn't bother me whether Winwood was thinking of the romance of the night or TV commercial residuals when he wrote it. The big drawback to having your song in a commercial, however, is that it gets played and repeated so often that whatever initial charm or mystery the song might have is soon just worn away through the combined repetition of TV and radio. At the other extreme from Winwood's pervasive pop is the rigorous rap music of Public Enemy, who, I think it's safe to say, will never be tapped to write TV jingles.
Too black, too strong. Too black, too strong.
Yo, Chuck, these early drippers are still front on us. Show them that we can do this, cause we always do this. Yeah, boy.
Bass, how low can you go? Death row, what a brother, no. Once again, back is the incredible rhyme animal, the uncannibal beast. Public Enemy number one, 5-4 said freeze, and I got numb. Can I tell them that I really never had a gun? But it's the wax that the Terminator X-bun. Now they got me in a cell, cause my records they sell. Cause a brother like me said, well, Farrakhan's a prophet, and I think you wanna listen to what he can say to you. What you wanna do is follow for now. Power the people say, make a miracle, keep up the lyrical. Black is back, all in, we're gonna win, check it out.
Yeah, yo, come on.
Here we go again. Bring the noise.
Public Enemy's new album, entitled It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back, is rap music's cutting edge. The music is built on layers and layers of riffs, sound effects, and harsh human voices. Public Enemy speaks favorably of black nationalism and Louis Farrakhan, thus guaranteeing that very little of this album will be played on commercial radio. I love the record on any number of levels. In its construction, it's the only truly avant-garde piece of popular music around right now. But on a more immediate level, this was the only music that fully conveyed the heat of the summer.
Brothers and sisters! Brothers and sisters, I don't know what this world is coming to.
Yes, the rhythm's a rebel. Without a pause, I'm lowering my level. The hard rhymer, where you never been, I'm in. You want styling? You know it's time again. D, the enemy, telling you to hear it. They praise the music, it's time to play the lyrics. Some say no to the album, the show. Bum rush the sound I made a year ago. I guess you know, you guess I'm just a radical. Not on sabbatical, yes, to make it critical. The only part of your body should be part of it too. Pass the power on the hour from the rebel to you.
Hey, yo, Chuck, man, I don't understand this, man. Yo, you got to slow down, man, you're losing them.
Radio, suckers never play me. On the mix, they just okay me now. Knowing and growing, when the clock in my zone is known. Sneaking and taking everything that the brother owns.
Hard.
My calling card, recorded and ordered. Supporter of Chess and Mart, loud and proud. Kicking live, next poet supreme. Loop for truth, bazooka for scheme.
Flavor,
a rebel in his own mind. Supporter of my rhyme, designed to scatter a line of suckers who claim I do crime. They are my time, dig it.
Hey, yo, Chuck, I think we take it short. Show them this is Cole Medina, man. Come on, kick it.
Terminator X.
Finally, there's one song I encountered everywhere, on the radio, on TV as a video, seeping out of the earphones of other people's Walkmans as I rode the train into work. Better Be Home Soon by the band called Crowded House was the summer's loveliest song as well as its most obsessive. The song was written and sung by Neil Finn, and it's about falling in love with someone who doesn't return that love. Cast as a sentimental ballad, the lyrics reveal something else, an edgy confusion that slowly, over the course of the song, increases to desperation. The song's lilting pop melody has prompted many people to compare it to the Beatles, and Neil Finn's plaintive singing makes him sound like Paul McCartney's cousin. But ultimately, Neil Finn and Crowded House have created their own sort of haunting melancholy, and have given the summer of '88 its signature song.
Stripping back the coats of lies and deception, back to nothingness, like a week in the desert. And I know I'm right.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. This is Fresh Air. Actor Saeed Jaffrey is as comfortable playing Shakespeare as he is playing characters drawn from the history of his native India. You may know him for his role as the Pakistani uncle in the film My Beautiful Laundrette. He also appeared in the films Gandhi and A Passage to India. Jaffrey co-stars with Pierce Brosnan in the new film The Deceivers, produced by Ismail Merchant. It's set in India in 1825, and it's based on the true story of a British East India Company official, played by Brosnan, who discovers a secret cult of criminals called the Tugs, or the Deceivers. The Tugs link up with wealthy travelers on the road. Then they strangle the travelers with weighted silken scarves and steal their jewels. Joffrey plays a Tug arrested by Pierce Brosnan. Brosnan wants to infiltrate the cult, and Joffrey becomes his guide.
Greetings, Ali, my brother.
Why did he call you that?
It is a Tug password. Where all, Ali?
And those travelers?
Yes, if the omens are favorable, they will all be killed.
Had you heard about the Tugs before doing this role?
Yes, I had.
Had you heard stories about them as a child?
Yes, I'd read stories about them as a child. Then I read this novel about 30 years ago. Yeah, in the 50s, yeah. I read the novel, The Deceivers.
In the making of the film The Deceivers,
yes.
Did you have to learn how to use the...
The rumal?
Yes, the
handkerchief.
The scarf that's used to strangle people.
Yes,
with a lightning
speed. Yes, we did. That was our first lesson.
Who trained you?
Brian Smithies was one of the guys, our special effects man. And then Jerry Crampton, the stunt coordinator. How funny that both these would be English people teaching the Indians how to use the handkerchief.
Yeah, I see your point.
In the film, of course, they've used a sound effect which dramatizes it a little more and makes it more menacing.
Sure, it's the sound.
The swish.
That's the sound.
And then
that's right.
That.
You star in The Deceivers along with Shashi Kapoor, another Indian actor who has also made
some films in the West.
Exactly, some films in the West.
Unlike me, he's based more in India and has been all his life. And though every now and then, like Heat and Dust and Sammy and Rosie, he has done in the West. But otherwise, most of his work is in India, whereas most of my work was in England.
The film is produced by Ishmael Merchant.
Ishmael Merchant.
Who is also Indian-born, but has produced most of his movies.
In the West.
In the West.
Yes.
Do you think that The Deceivers could have been produced by an Indian film company in India?
If it had been, it would probably have been 3 hours long and would have had five or six songs and three or four dances.
How come?
Because that's what they expect. That's what the Indian audiences expect from a movie, an entertainment which amuses them or entertains them or frightens them or whatever, for at least 3 hours.
You first left India in 1956 to study acting at the Royal Academy of Dramatic Arts
in
England. Why did you want to leave India?
Because there were no drama schools in England, in India. And most of my work, my theatre company was an English language theatre company in Delhi. And we did Tennessee Williams, and we did Shakespeare, and we did Ibsen, and we did Christopher Fry, and T.S. Eliot, and so on. But and we learnt on our feet, but I still felt that I should go to a Western institution and try my mettle, my talent, against stiffer competition in England and in America.
What was that experience like for you?
It was challenging. It kept you. I mean, even if you got a six-line part, you had to enrich it and imbue it with so much truth that it would be remembered. And maybe 6 months later or a year later, the same director might have another part for you. It was a struggle. Yes, it was a struggle. But it was. I mean, I look back on it as a wonderfully sort of strengthening of the sinews kind of struggle, which every actor can do with.
Now, did you ever have trouble getting the kinds of roles that you wanted because you were an Indian actor?
Yes. But I had broken through the mold. You know, being selected for Shakespeare, for instance, and then in New York, my first play being a Spanish tragedy. So I was lucky enough to have broken the barrier, you know, because, in fact, there were no Indian parts at that time. And if I had only been playing Indian parts, I would have died a long time ago. Passage to India, in fact, was my first major Indian role on Broadway, in which I played the part that Alec Guinness plays in the film, mm-hmm. Professor Godbole. And then we started a thing called a multiracial company called The Theater in the Street, and we played Molière in the streets of Harlem and Bedford-Stuyvesant. And that was a heady experience. So, I mean, there were lots of joys that one looks back on, even though the struggle was there.
Let me ask you about a movie you made a couple of years ago, My Beautiful Laundrette.
Yes.
And in this movie, you played a businessman who is who wants to take his nephew into the business.
Yes.
And You're a Pakistani businessman living in London.
Yes.
You have a mistress.
Yes.
But a very traditional family at the same time.
Yes.
And you're trying to kind of keep one from the other.
Right.
This is a scene in which you've invited your nephew to the restaurant and you're giving him some advice. I want to play this scene for you.
Please do.
Don't deliberately egg me on to laugh at you when I brought you here to tell you one essential thing. Now move closer. Get up. In this damned country, which we hate and love, you can get anything you want. It's all spread out and available. That's why I believe in England. Only you have to know how to squeeze the tits of the system.
He's saying that he wants to help you.
What do you want to do with me?
What am I going to do with you? Turn you into something damn good. Now your father can't do it, can he?
When you in that scene describe England as this damn country which we
hate and love.
I mean, in the film you could tell that this man loves the country because there's a lot of opportunities to make money,
right.
But he hates the country because Pakistanis are discriminated against.
Right.
And I wonder if you've ever felt that way about England or the United States as a country that you both hate and love.
I never felt that about the United States at all. In England, it was a bit tougher because there was this discrimination when I first went there in 67. And though I personally never came across it in my working area, I did go through in 1971 and 72 what I called a season of muggings, where I was mugged. I mean, in fact, when I, by fascists, you know, late at night or something like that. But it never embittered me, because I think no actor must ever allow himself to get either smug or bitter, because these elements exist in all societies. And they're only a small part of that thing. They're merely the reminder that there are the evil forces, that one must concentrate on the good forces and inform them with whatever whatever experiences you have had in your life.
So when you went through this period of getting mugged,
yes,
did you learn how to street fight afterwards?
No, it was quite bad because, you know, I became quite paranoid for a little while because I used to then, I had a Scottish girlfriend at that time, and she used to be my protector, and she used to walk just almost in front of me with her, you know, her fists, or, you know, like a boxer, you know, and says, "Oh, I'll show them. How dare they?" And says, "Oh, well, look at that man over there. I think he's coming." You know, all this. So then we'd laugh about it so much that there was no time to get embittered.
So how are you dividing your time now between the United States, England, and India?
Well, because of the quantity of work, last couple of years I've spent more time in India, but I always make sure that I can, I mean, I'd love to do something here. You know, I think I want to come full circle. I began here as an actor. I want to do something here. I'm still a member of Equity, SAG, AFTRA, all those sort of things. And I'd love to do something in North America again, something relevant, something like My Beautiful Laundrette.
It must be good to not have to choose between the two worlds, between India or the West, and to live in both and make movies in both.
It is. I think it is. But one humbly feels that one has earned that place.
Right.
Through all the struggles.
Okay. Thank you so much.
God bless you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Actor Saeed Jaffrey co-stars with Pierce Brosnan and Shashi Kapoor in the new film The Deceivers. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered and check in with guest host Daniel Zwerdlich. Hi, Danny.
Good afternoon, Ms. Gross.
Yeah, I should take attendance after that. What do you have for us?
Well, Stray's about political events in Poland, quite serious ones, political events in Afghanistan, too. But let's get to the real meat of the show tonight. Our intrepid reporter, Peter Breslow, is almost, not quite, but he's almost at Mount Everest. Their trucks got lost or something. He's getting a little antsy, I think. And also an extraordinary story about a man who is convinced that that classic song, American Pie, do you know that one?
Uh-huh.
Bye-bye, Miss American Pie, is a message from God that Armageddon, the end, is coming to America.
Well, thanks for singing for us. Those
You're
stories
welcome.
And more are coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. John Sayles is not cut from Hollywood cloth. He writes and directs his own screenplays, works with a relatively small budget, and usually plays a bit part himself. His films include The Return of the Secaucus 7, Brother from Another Planet, and Meet One. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review of Sayles' latest, Eight Men Out.
Ever since I was a little kid, I've longed to see a movie about the Black Sox scandal of 1919. To an American youngster, it seemed unbelievable that eight members of the Chicago White Sox could actually have managed to throw the World Series. But in fact, corruption ran rampant in baseball during the early part of the century. The Black Sox scandal was what brought the need for regulation into the public eye. It's a fascinating story, and the writer-director John Sayles knows it. 11 years ago, he wrote the screenplay for Eight Men Out as his audition script to get screenwriting jobs. And as its first half hour unfolds, you can feel the gusto and imagination that went into it. In one long, brilliantly lucid sequence, Sayles introduces a galaxy of personalities, good ballplayers and bad, journalists, gamblers Big Time and Penny Ante, and the skinflint team owner, Charles Comiskey. That sequence, unfortunately, is the movie's last spark of life. Sales has chosen to make Eight Men Out a juiceless and didactic Marxist demonstration. According to him, the eight ballplayers who collaborated to let the Cincinnati Reds win the series were ordinary Joes trapped in a hopeless system. They had no union. They had no future. They were paid the worst wages in the league. And their boss, Comiskey, well, here's how he treated his best pitcher.
You said if I won 30 games this year, there'd be a $10,000 bonus.
So?
I think you owe it to me.
Harry, how many games does Mr. Seacott win for us this year?
29, sir.
You had Kid bench me for 2 whole weeks in August. I missed 5 starts.
We had to rest your arm for the series.
I would have won at least 2 of those games. You knew that.
I have to keep the best interests of the club in mind, Eddie.
I think you owe me that bonus.
29 is not 30, Eddie. You will get only the money you deserve.
Now, I buy Sales' political theory of the scandal, hook, line, and sinker. What I don't buy is the way he makes his movie feel like an argument instead of a story. Although there are good actors and good performances everywhere you look, especially David Strathairn as that ace pitcher, Sales makes the characters strangely bloodless. Again and again we see gamblers approach players, but since we scarcely know any of them, all we get are the mechanisms of corruption, not the drama. Sales sticks little moral indicators everywhere to tell us what to think. Long-suffering wives who suffer even more as their hubbies blow the game. Even Sales' period trappings seem stiff and inorganic, from the ragtime music on the soundtrack to the flavor of the dialogue, which swings wildly between a satisfying complexity and the sort of Cracker Barrel wisdom you'd expect to find in a 30s radio play. And though much of what Sales wants to demonstrate is how feckless these schemers and dreamers were, what should be a comedy of errors becomes merely confusing. Sales first came to moviegoers' attention as the writer of garbagey films like Piranha and Alligator, which he redeemed with his unusually witty dialogue. Now that he's become the lofty writer-director of his own dream projects, all that subversive wit has given way to a deadly message-mongering earnestness that I find pretty unbecoming. Sales could use a strong injection of the old commercial trash sensibility he's escaped from. Maybe he should even take a lesson from his ballplayers. Maybe, just a little bit, John Sayles ought to sell out.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair and is a contributing correspondent to West 57. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with Sean Slovo, who wrote the screenplay for the film A World Apart. It's the story of a girl growing up in South Africa and her mother, who's active in the struggle against apartheid. The movie is also Sean Slovo's story. Our new performer-in-residence, pianist Dick Hyman, will play and discuss the music of composer and pianist Jelly Roll Morton. And critic-at-large Laurie Stone will review the Broadway revival of Ain't Misbehaving, featuring the music of Fats Waller. This revival is performed by the original cast, including Nell Carter. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from NPR member stations and from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Our engineer is Audrey Vlaidis. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.